This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The year is 2009, and Gertie, we're not podcasts. We're people. Do you understand? The movie, Moon.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to
Unspooled.
That was truly amazing. I am Paul Scheer. I'm a master singer. I'm a lover of movies. I am joined by my friend, my cohort, film aficionado, a critic that often writes for the New York Times and now even the Washington Post, Amy Nicholson. Amy, how are you?
Hello, Paul. I am wonderful.
I am excited. I just got back from South by Southwest at a movie that premiered out there, and it was a lot of fun. I'm curious to see what you will think of this movie, because the movie is like Happy Madison meets Dumb and Dumber by way of Kingpin. It's an insanely fun movie, and we had a really fun...
I have been in the mood for that. That sounds wonderful.
Shameik Moore, Darcy Carden, Paul Reiser, Susan Sarandon. And I got to hang out with Susan Sarandon, who was asking about these podcasts that we do. And she asked me if I had done any of her movies on How Did This Get Made, to which I said, I don't remember, but we definitely did, Thelma and Louise, on this show. And I love that episode.
We did. And Rocky Horror Picture Show, which I wanted to go into space. And you said no.
Speaking of which, I did win our Oscar bet, which means that I could take any film off the list. Now, I have to say, you and I have done a very good job on this list. Because I look at this list and I go, God damn it. There's not much that I'm angry about on this list. Like, this list is pretty good. Like, there are moments here, there are things I'm like, okay, maybe I won't feel like that way in a year, but I don't want to take that off. I like what it represents ultimately. And every one of these films, I can argue with myself and say, well, that belongs. That needs to be on there. There's not one film that I'm upset with, which I think is a sign of a great list. But because it's a bet and I live up to my betting, I am going to kill Intolerance. And I know you're not going to like it. I know you're not going to like it, but I'm going to kill Intolerance. Maybe we'll have another chance. I understand what it represents. I understand that 1916, this is a great film. D.W. Griffith, I get why it's amazing.
But have nothing else from the 1910s.
We'll get there. We'll get there. But I got to tell you, I'm looking at that list and I can't do it. Like, I was thinking, well, maybe I'll take off Bridesmaids. But I'm like, no, I'm going to take off one of the few films that's like a female front to come. We don't really have that. I'm like, all right, well, maybe I'll take off, you know, Jackass. I'm like, well, that's, like, I feel like that's representing something really interesting. I think that we have a lot of interesting silent films. I think that we have some really good stuff on this list. And it was the only movie that I could look at and feel perfectly okay with. Everything else gave me a hesitation. Something about it that made me go, I don't want to get rid of that. And especially the ones, I was going to take off Ganja and Hess. And I'm like, what does that say? If I take off Ganja and Hess, I don't know. So right now. That's what I've done. Brutal. It's a brutal cup, but the one I feel good about.
Negative Hollywood history, no longer represented. You, sir, have just signed up for me to pick out another silent film from that decade.
Okay, well, let me just also say The General was 1926, right? You know, so we have, you know, we're there, you know, we're roughly there.
That's 16 years into Hollywood history.
All right.
Hollywood could already drive.
Oh my gosh, I just realized my son's going to be 10 years old in a month, and that really freaked me out. But you know what?
Wow, the hordes of Babylon, that's what you are. You are
I know. I feel badly. But you know what? We
First
do
they
have.
Take down the elephants at Hollywood and Highland. Now you.
That's it. But we do have A Trip to the Moon. That's also 1902. We got movies on there. We have some movies on there. Amy, this movie Moon was something that we talked about a lot last week. And we talked about this idea of like, this is the actor's vanity project. The actor who does it all is going to do it here for us. And this is a movie that you and I both really remembered very affectionately. It's a movie I talk about very highly. But, you know, on the rewatch, I had some issues.
Yeah, I was nervous about this rewatch. I'm going to try very hard to get into the headspace of where I was when I saw this, when I was blown away and dazzled in 2009. I mean, I will say one thing that excites me about going back to The Dark Side of the Moon, where this is set, is I found out while I was researching this that on The Dark Side of the Moon, there is a crater named Nicholson. It is 23 and a half miles across. I am now very proud of this thing that I have just heard about. Apparently, there was a guy named Seth B. Nicholson who 100 years ago discovered three moons of Jupiter. I never met him. He also has a crater named after him on Mars, 63 miles across. What do you think about that? 63 miles crater with my name on it.
Wow. I am impressed. Very, very impressed. You are amazing.
You.
And I am there. you know, Amy, I will say this. Sam Rockwell is fantastic in this movie. That's undeniable. I think there's a lot of big ideas in this movie. This is a movie that I would like to see a sequel to. We'll talk about how there is kind of a quasi sequel to this film and so much more. But you know what? So without any further ado, Gertie, please start our 3-year stint on the moon.
Yes, I will unspool it.
The year is 2009 and Sam Rockwell is finally about to blast off into stardom. He has been in the acting game for 2 decades. Now, the first decade was rough. The second was a little bit better because he's been getting small supporting parts in biggish films like Galaxy Quest, Matchstick Men, Charlie's Angels, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, and The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. And also the leads in indies that most people haven't seen. But people kind of know his face, but not everyone knows his name, and he has yet to get that part.
And then comes Duncan Jones's Moon, which not only gives Sam Rockwell that part, it gives him all the parts. Sam plays a space miner named Sam Bell. You always know, by the way, that I think a part's going to be worth watching when the filmmaker names the character after the actor that he voted for. The setting is the future, and Sam Bell has signed a 3-year contract to farm for helium on the moon, alone, with nothing but the space station's AI robot Gertie for companionship. Gertie was voiced after the fact, after the movie was shot, by Kevin Spacey. Up on the moon, Sam watches pre-recorded videos from his wife Tess and his daughter Eve, and he gets ready to finally go home. His contract is up. And then he meets another Sam Bell, who is also played by Sam Rockwell. How are there two Sams? Who copied who? Who is the original Sam Bell?
Now, Moon actually launches 2 breakouts. The second is its director, Duncan Jones, who wrote the script with Nathan Parker. Duncan had an okay career doing commercials, but if he's known for anything, he's known for being David Bowie's son. And Moon finally gives him a name of his own, too. In 2009, this was the long shot indie movie that people said, boy, wouldn't it be nice if it got an Oscar nomination, especially for Sam Rockwell as an actor? But it didn't get any Oscar nominations, but it did get a lot of goodwill, and it put Sam Rockwell on track to get the parts that will earn him back-to-back Oscar nominations in 2018 and 2019, and he'll win one for 3 billboards over Ebbing, Missouri. God damn it. I'm just mad about that movie.
Are you mad about the Missouri?
Still.
Still. Moon came out on June 12th, 2009. It cost $5 million and it made $10 million. Not a huge hit, but in my circle, it felt like everybody was talking about Moon, and they still have not stopped talking about Moon. So what was in the zeitgeist that weekend? The number one song was a major, major, major hit, full stop. We are talking 12 weeks at number one on the charts. And it includes a very harsh warning that nobody should be copying anybody else's swagger. Don't copy Sam's swagger. Do not copy Fergie's swagger, especially because in this song, Fergie, like Sam, is from the future. It is the Black Eyed Peas and Boom Boom Pow.
I like that boom boom pow. Them chickens jacking my style. They try to copy my swagger. I'm on that niche now. I'm sold 3008. You sold 2000 and late. I got that boom boom boom. That future boom boom boom. Let me get it now.
Boom boom boom. Gotta get that boom boom boom. Gotta get that boom boom boom. Gotta get that
boom boom pow. Amy. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. You know, you are so right about the fact that everyone was talking about Moon. And in the rewatch of it, I think I really, really appreciate so much that is there. I mean, especially, I know we're going to talk about him a lot today, but Sam Rockwell is fantastic in this film. I also think it's amazing to see what you could do on a low budget in making a really high concept, very cool movie. But I think the reason that got everybody excited about this movie was it was a magic trick. It was something that, holy shit, you got to check this out. And not a magic trick like The Crying Game, like a twist. It was just this kind of culmination of a lot of things. Like we said, the actor, the director, the idea. And it was interesting. I was going into like, I can't wait to rewatch this. This is going to be great. And I found myself actually feeling like, oh, yeah, this is good. I like this. I wasn't as blown away as I felt the first time, or even as I talk about it. Like, if I didn't see this movie again, I would still talk about it like, well, and Moon, and Moon, and Moon. I just found myself a little bit more like, this is great, but a little bit of that magic of the first time wore off.
I was nervous about that too, rewatching this, because to me, this movie is so much about its revelation, which I assume we can just talk about this right now. There's a bunch of,
yeah,
there's a bunch of Sam Bells, all in storage on this ship. And in my memory of the film, that revelation took place a lot later in the film, that it was
absolutely,
that was more like a, who is real? What is real? Kind of a psychological exploration of that question. And when I rewatched it this time, nervously wondering like, will this hold up if I know what's coming? I was surprised that like the revelation just very fast. You're like, okay, yeah. The second Bell, yep, is like, I'm a clone. I got it. I'm clone.
Yeah. There's no stopping to be like, oh, that's odd. It, in a way, we are probably in a world in which clones do exist. I think that that's something that they don't really touch on,
oh,
even though that's really the twist at the end. I mean, because the reaction,
I hadn't thought about that, that they wouldn't be the first clone they might have heard of, that they would have heard of other clones,
or they built it into that clone's memory that he wouldn't freak out if he found another,
right,
version of him. Because like,
because there's no like, what's a clone? I didn't know you could be a clone. It's like, oh, I'm a clone. It's like, oh, you use a Samsung? Cool.
But you know, it really is interesting. Like when Sam Bell 2 brings in Sam Bell 1 to the station, you know, after he finds the barely alive Sam Bell from the harvester. And he's like, Who is he? It's like, well, it's you, but he looks just like him. I don't think we get to see that reaction, that real like moment of we are the same person. Like Sam Bell 2 looks at Sam Bell 1 like, huh, he does look a little bit like me, but they look identical. And I don't think take in that moment of what the fuck is going on. And I think that was my interpretation of the movie, or at least in my memory of the movie, was like, holy shit, you know, but there's no holy shit. It's just sort of like, who is this guy? I know it's me, but like, why is he there?
Yeah, that's my memory of this film too, that it was a holy shit movie. And instead, what really popped out was that Duncan Jones is like, I think, mapping out the beats of a holy shit movie, you know, and thinking like,
right,
okay, but I'm gonna dial down the holy shit on that one. Like, okay, we got like a creepy robot walking around this thing. Everybody's expecting that robot to be evil and go, holy shit.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna dial that down. I'm gonna make that robot pretty nice. You know, he's almost, I think, trying to do something interesting with being blasé about it.
I know.
Is that fair, or am I giving him a lot of credit?
No, you know, I think what was troubling to me about the rewatch. And this is like, again, going back to that idea of it being a magic trick. Right? The first time you're not asking these questions. The second time I am. And part of it is, I think he dips his toe into a lot of ideas, but doesn't really pay many of them off. You know, you talked about Gertie being someone who actually shows humanity. And then I think the movie is questioning, like, what is human? And, you know, is it fair to have a clone work under these false pretenses? But all those ideas, I think you have to do some of that digging yourself, and they're not really there. And, you know, the big twist of the movie is Sam Bell is actually a clone of this president of this company or this person involved in this company. He's made a clone of himself to work this space station on these 3-year cycles. And at the end of 3 years, he thinks he's going home, but he actually is being killed, or, you know, his body is deteriorating past 3 years. Like, it's a very,
yeah, it's sad. He gets in what he thinks is going to be his capsule home and it like explodes him or something.
Yes. No, it kind of like, I feel like it burns him or does something. Yeah.
Yeah. It goes kaboom. It's black and white. I can't tell if it's blood or smoke or char.
I don't know. Yeah. It just seems like a microwave oven or something. But
yeah. Oh yeah. He's like what? Like a potato in an oven.
But it oddly is leaking on the bottom. The other thing about this movie that I really thought about this time, and I'm poking some holes, obviously, but Gertie seems pretty sufficient. Why can't that whole station be run by a Gertie?
Yeah, Gertie's like cruising. I mean, yeah. The only thing I think that Gertie cannot do is Gertie cannot get off his like ceiling track, which is right. A cool design.
Yes.
I like the idea of like a robot who's like suspended on a track instead of clumsily walking around. Because thank God for right now, in the year of our Lord 2024, robots are not that good at running yet. Maybe they are. I'm scared about the day when they get better at it. But like, robot on a track, kind of sleek, you know, like a monorail. Cool. But I guess the robot can't go outside. But then I guess if you could make clones, you could probably make a monorail track that goes outside. But these are questions I wasn't asking the first time I watched it.
No.
Because it was a magic trick. And oh, I feel bad that we're kind of right away, right at the top of Moon going, oh, the movie was a little meh, wasn't it? On the second watch?
Yeah.
It was a little meh.
I think what's not meh is the performance. Right? The performance is really wonderful to watch. And it's one of those movies that you truly forget the magic trick of Sam Rockwell not being two or three different people. It's him doing all that work by himself. And it really feels full and rich. I think he does a lot with a little bit of exposition because, you know, what we're supposed to believe is that every clone that wakes up is waking up as Sam Bell at the point in which he was cloned, which seems to be a Sam Bell with anger issues. And over the course of these 3 years, I think the arc of the Sam Bell clone is to work on his anger issues, gives him a moment, gives him a reason to be in space. Like, it's like a 3-year therapy mission mixed with like, manual labor.
Right. Like, we can get a glimpse of that from the way that Tess talks when, like, he has one of his first pre-recorded videos with Tess.
I know you're really lonely up there. But I think in a lot of ways it's been really good for you. For both of us. God, I hope you don't mind me saying that. I'm proud of you.
And I guess I was wondering, is that an implant or is that true to Sam Bell? Because Sam Bell never worked there. Like, I think I remembered it as being like it was based on the original guy who worked. I mean, again, I'm making a lot of assumptions for what I thought, but to know that Sam Bell never did the 3-year stint there, or maybe he did the first 3-year stint. I don't know. I don't think he probably did.
I think we have to make a lot of assumptions about Sam Bell because they're not in the movie, mm-hmm. right? Because the fact that there is a guy on Earth, still living there with Eve, the daughter, who is a teenager. And I suppose Sam Bell is like a big...
Like an Elon Musk?
Yeah, like is he like an Elon Musk muckety-muck, you know, who's like so narcissistic that he decided that all the clones on the moon base had to look like him? Or is he so self-punishing he like secretly loathes himself and he wants different versions of himself to go through like moon therapy? Like, why, if you're the CEO, what are you doing?
Or is he just an industrialist who is
right,
like, this is nothing. This is nothing. This is just what we need to get the helium from the moon. You know, it's like he is.
This is low tier joke of like, haha, I made a bunch of me. I made a bunch of minions and they all look like me.
I mean, isn't that the whole idea of what stormtroopers are, right? They're all supposed to look like Jango Fett, right?
I think that was true.
I think there's like part of the lore of the stormtroopers are they're all clones.
Oh, is that why they call it the Clone Wars?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't watched any of that.
Yeah, so I think that, and by the way, I'm sorry, Star Wars fans, if I'm messing that up, but that idea is...
Thank you for
is,
making this episode even nerdier, Paul. I really appreciate that.
But, you know, I think that there's this idea about capitalism, right? That's probably what this movie is trying to talk about on some level. And humanity. You know, we put people in dangerous positions to improve our planet. And that's something that I think is a core, interesting theme that is universal that we can all get behind. You know, the rich people stay safe and the poor people go up and they are put in these positions and are disposable.
Yeah. Which is not that different than what Elon Musk's actual plan is for colonizing Mars. Like his whole thing, I believe, is yeah. Sign up with me. You can be the first settlers of Mars. But it's basically like indentured servitude again. You know, like when people would move to America and just be like workers for the rest of their life. He's like, do that, but you can do it for me on Mars.
And I think that this movie probably could have been a lot more grand in its ideas if it's all compacted and the movie continues where it ends. Because, you know, Sam Bell 2 or Sam Bell 302, who knows how long, escapes. He gets home, and this starts this other part of the movie that we'll never see. I mean, even though Duncan Jones has said he wanted to make a sequel.
Yeah, we get like a taste of it here. There's the news reports right when he crash lands on Earth.
Clone 6, the clone of Sam Bell, has been giving evidence at CEA's board of directors meeting in Seattle.
You know what? He's one of two things. He's a wacko or an illegal immigrant. Either way, they need to lock him up.
And then, you know, years later, Duncan Jones did sort of a side splinter sequel where like one of the characters in the future is watching the TV and you can see Sam Bell in court testifying against original Sam Bell. You see the OG original Sam Bell on the phone with like a big beard. Like he's on the TV in this court getting, I guess, yelled at. It seems very complicated. Just picture this scene. It's like 9 seconds. There's a bunch of Sam Bells in a courtroom. And that's it. That's the last we know of the story.
Do something, man. My name is Sam Bell.
So's mine, pal.
Hey, so some kind of hearing happened, and who knows what happens from hearings. But I guess a lot of other Sam Bells made it down, so I don't know how that happened either.
Well, wait. More Sam Bells made it down?
Yeah, in the sequel, Mute.
Oh, okay. Wait.
That he did. Well, it's sort of a sequel. It's sort of not a sequel. Basically, I will jump back a second. So Mute is a film that Duncan Jones wanted to make before he made Moon.
Yes,
and it's about,
I know
like,
that.
A mute person running around, blah, blah, blah. And the story that I heard is that he brought the Mute script to Sam Rockwell.
Yes.
And said, will you do this movie with me? And Sam Rockwell was like, I don't know. And they couldn't decide what character they'd want him to play. And he sort of backed out. And so then Duncan Jones went home and wrote Moon specifically for Sam Rockwell so that he could work with him. And then was like, always like, Mute is my passion project. I will make Mute. Mute will be the greatest film ever. Finally makes Mute. Doesn't really get much attention. I haven't seen it. The reviews don't look good. But he does have 9 seconds of Sam Bell in the future in it with a bunch of other Sam Bells.
Wow, that's interesting. So he created an MCU, a Moon cinematic universe here, but we're not getting to see. We're not getting to see it.
Hey, everybody, it's Rob Lowe here. If you haven't heard, I have a podcast that's called Literally with Rob Lowe. And basically, it's conversations I've had that really make you feel like you're pulling up a chair at an intimate dinner between myself and people that I admire, like Aaron Sorkin or Tiffany Haddish, Demi Moore, Chris Pratt, Michael J. Fox. There are new episodes out every Thursday. So subscribe, please, and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I don't know. This feels to me like we're talking about it because of Sam Rockwell and the magic trick of Sam Rockwell. Like, I mean, and the magic trick that he does by being such a great actor and giving these characters who are clones, who are not terribly different than each other, very different perspectives. And I thought that was really interesting because it's not like, I'm the kick-ass guy and I'm the meek person. You know, it's
I'm the good clone. I'm the mean clone. I'm the villain clone with the mustache clone. I'm the good clone with the sideburns clone.
And by the way, Amy, your one-person show of Moon is still one of my favorite LA theater experiences.
But he goes beyond the aesthetics, right?
Like, yes.
I was worried at first it would be like, okay, so there's like black-eyed clone who's limping around, and then there's like young and vibrant clone. But he really does give them different inner lives, I guess. That like the clone has been working on the moon for a long time, battered clone. We can call him, I don't know, Sam 1, what are we going to call him? Sam 1?
Sam 1 and Sam 2 for the
Sam 1 and Sam 2.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm with Sam 1. Sam 1 feels kind of like a company guy. You know, he's like, I've put in my time. I've done my work. I cannot believe that this company would betray me. And Sam 2 comes in hot. Sam 2 is like, I don't trust anybody. Why can't I go out here? I'm going to do whatever you say I can't do. He's like almost a teenage Sam, right? He's like rebellious, youthful, spunky. Not resigned, Sam.
Well, this is the Sam that needs to go away and separate from his wife and child. You know, that's what we're kind of seeing. That's the subtle difference. Is like the angry Sam needs to go to the moon. The angry Sam needs to deal with his own shit. And I think there's something really interesting there that this is, I think, an implant to fuel the character to feel like they have something to accomplish outside of work. Right. It's that idea like, you know, very much like what Blade Runner puts in, you know, like what are these human things that we give to the androids that make them more human? And I believe that that is a very big part of Sam, because when Sam too, like kicks and destroys the model, like he's furious. Right. And he's like, I'm sorry, I lost my temper there. You know, I think that's what we're supposed to see, is that Sam Bell flies off the handle.
Right, but the idea of like giving an android or a clone, I want to make sure that I remember that these are clones and not androids,
right?
Because I know they are very different.
Yes.
But giving them a reason to live makes it in a way easier to control them, like a nice carrot on a stick, which seems like part of the cruel thing of Blade Runner, you know, to give those androids human traits and then make them long to be more than an android, which is just, it's a cruel thing of a human to do to an android, I think.
The humanity that Sam Bell, you know, both of them have, actually keeps them invested in running this moon base. And I think that that maybe answers my question about Gertie. Like, Gertie is just a computer, but Sam has to, beyond being like legs and arms, has to care for it and be attentive to it and be able to read subtle differences. You know, maybe it is a sociological experiment. I don't know. Again, we don't get these clues because the movie doesn't show us everything, but I do believe that humanity is what makes this place work. Like, they may have tried it a different way and it didn't work until they actually had a human there doing it.
I mean, we can tell that Duncan is definitely very influenced by Blade Runner. I mean, he goes out of his way to have Sam name one of his pet plants Ridley. He's also a guy who, like, in his commercial life was always working with Ridley Scott's brother, you know, Tony Scott. Like,
yeah.
Tony Scott was, I think, a mentor to him. So the Scotts are very important in his life. So I can imagine him trying to distill the ideas of Blade Runner and try to figure out his own way through it.
Well, and I also think he's talking about, like, the prison that we all live in, right? Like, I think that, like, Blade Runner is really interesting because it's like trying to figure out, you know, who are you? And I think that even when you're a human, you're like, what do I want to be? How do I want to be perceived? Like, we're not struggling with, am I a human or am I not? But I think we are asking ourselves, like, what is the point of this life? And I think that in this movie, you see Duncan Jones doing interesting things. Again, an idea that doesn't get fully layered, but like these five dots arranged in a, I think it's called a quincux or a quincunx. It's a single dot surrounded by four other dots. It's a, basically in the criminal underworld, that represents prison, the central dot being the person, while the other four represent prison walls. And I feel like that's another idea,
I
too.
I never heard that.
Yeah, that's throughout the movie, I was looking at that. I was like, oh, that's an interesting logo. And then I did some research and found out that's what it was. So
when I went to prison, I didn't get any cool tattoos.
You see, look, that's what I'm saying. But you know, is this a movie about prison? Is this a movie about, and maybe it is, because we're talking about this idea of like reforming yourself, getting better.
Well, then that makes me think that like the true mastermind is not like OG Sam on Earth living with his teen daughter, but maybe his wife, Tess, was the CEO. And she was like, my husband really has to go work on himself. I'm going to just send endless variations of him up into space. But then, you know, when you look at you get that little montage when Sam's like looking at the videos of like the past Sams who used to live there. And they all have different haircuts too. Like some of the Sams grew their hair out really long. Some got beards. Some got sideburns. And I kind of like this question of, is the movie even asking this question of like, do we humans exist with a core personality, but micro changes can shift who we become? Like, is it opening the door to like a nature versus nurture question? Like, was Gertie more prone to playing classic rock when one of the other guys was like in a sleep coma or something? A different alarm clock song. I don't even know. And so one Sam grows up being more of like a cool 70s looking bro, and another Sam grows up looking more military. Like, are there micro shifts in this base that would result in all of the Sams having different haircuts? Because they all have different haircuts. Why do they have different haircuts?
If one Sam doesn't watch Mary Tyler Moore, then, you know, maybe another one watches, you know, Newhart. And that changes
Well, you know
everything.
What I want them to watch?
What?
Because I was thinking, like, you know, with The Martian, how The Martian was always watching old episodes of The Fonz.
Yeah.
And then here in Moon, he's watching, you know, old episodes of Bewitched. I was like wondering, what would I be watching if I was in space? And I really thought about all the sitcoms I love, and I came up with an answer.
Okay.
But I also want to hear your answer to what would be your astronaut space sitcom.
Oh, interesting. Well, you go first because you know your answer.
I definitely know mine. It is something that has been on my mind ever since I played a clip from it, I think, a couple episodes ago. It's Married with Children.
You saw God's shoes.
They were perfect, kids. Close fitting, surrounding each toe individually, probably a soft worked kid leather.
Well, what did you say to God?
I said, where'd you get those shoes?
That feels the most like the sitcom I will be watching. It feels like the sitcom I would just love to have on endlessly in the background if I was in a space.
You know, it's funny that you go to Married with Children, which is a long running sitcom. And again, Amy, you never cease to amaze me. It's interesting because I thought to myself, ooh, I'd watch these shows that I would always want to watch. I saw it as a chance to like kind of catch up on all the things I never had seen instead of like having a comfort food. It's like that movie Leave the World Behind with Julia Roberts. One of the main plot lines in that is the daughter is getting to the end of Friends. And,
oh, I got so mad at that. That was so annoying.
I hated that. But yeah, to me, I looked at it more as a chance to catch up on all the great things that I never did watch. And I thought also for it being 2035, why are they watching like black and white sitcoms?
Yeah. He should be watching Married with Children.
Yeah.
He should totally be watching Married with Children.
Or he should be getting a better live feed of things. But I guess maybe the thing is,
they're trying to prove that he gets old stuff, but like they're really going hard. Like you get Bewitched. I mean, that's hardcore. Like you are getting such old stuff that you're getting stuff that was only on TV when like we landed on the moon for the very first time.
I know. I mean, again, and that I think is all part of sci-fi, whatever bullshit.
Yeah.
But
I do want to tell you this though. I, in all seriousness, picked Married with Children, knew that Married with Children was the answer in my heart of what would be my astronaut movie. And then as I was researching our intro to the show, realized there is an amazing connection between Married with Children and the Black Eyed Peas. So, Married with Children star David Faustino in the early 90s wanted to be a rapper. You might remember this as being a subplot in Married with Children where he became a rapper called Grandmaster B, and everybody just kept fucking up the name as much as they could. So, around that same time in the early 90s, David Faustino opened up his own rap club, and he called it Ballistics. And at Ballistics, Will.i.am and Apple the Yap got discovered there with their very first dance crew by Eazy-E, because it was like a cool hangout in the early 90s. So Eazy-E discovered two of the four members who would go on to be the Black Eyed Peas. He was going to turn them into the West Coast Diggable Planets. This was Eazy-E's idea, but then they died. So from then, they mutated on their own and they became the Black Eyed Peas. But that is because of David Faustino.
Hey, everybody, it's Rob Lowe here. If you haven't heard, I have a podcast that's called Literally with Rob Lowe. And basically, it's conversations I've had that really make you feel like you're pulling up a chair at an intimate dinner between myself and people that I admire, like Aaron Sorkin or Tiffany Haddish, Demi Moore, Chris Pratt, Michael J. Fox. There are new episodes out every Thursday. So subscribe, please, and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, I know we talked a little bit about Blade Runner and the connection to Blade Runner. Now we've talked about the Faustino connection. But there was one other connection kind of bringing us back to our roots about this show, the AFI Top 100 list. One of the movies that I didn't like, that you liked, and I feel like I should give it a second chance, but I have yet to do that. High Noon.
Oh, yes.
This movie feels very much like High Noon. It also, which I didn't understand, feels like this movie Outland with Sean Connery, which I did like. So if Outland, which is a movie I like, is based on High Noon, is a movie I don't like, then I probably will like High Noon, and I maybe just saw it under weird
Are you saying this feels like High Noon because there's that countdown to when the dudes are going to show up at the space station?
Well, first of all, Outland seems to be like a remake of High Noon. So this seems to be like a remake of Outland. Mining Company, questionable methods, driven only by profits. And there is this idea of a countdown, right? They're coming. And when are they coming? And this, you know, these assassins. Yeah. So I guess you're right. I should just say, yes, the assassins are coming and we have to figure out what we're going to do. You know, this idea of covering up, using murder to cover up acts of corporate greed is probably at the base level of all three of these movies.
But you know what? I feel like this countdown element of Moon is another thing that maybe Duncan Jones is being too unpredictable, too clever, too something, too cranky down the holy shitness of it all, because nothing happens. Those guys show up. Everybody's already gone. There's no big confrontation. It's just this countdown. It's kind of a little bit of a whiff. It's like, all right.
And when you see those guys that are coming to save him, you're like, oh, these are fucking mercs. Like they don't look they don't look like they are like a helpful crew at all. They look like these are mugshots.
Do you think those are real people that they are bothering to keep on the moon? Or are they like also clones of like Earth mercs?
Oh, interesting. I think that they are company men. It seems like to get back and forth is only 3 days. So I think they just send them up to go get them. It didn't seem that hard.
I mean, this company doesn't make a lot of sense.
I mean, it's harvesting. I mean, look, there's a lot, you know, look, you want to get into the specifics of like the helium on the moon.
It's only two mercs. Couldn't they wake up a couple more Sams?
I mean, yeah, but you'd have to get those Sams all like, you'd have to get them on board. And like you said, they're, you know, maybe once one Sam sees three Sams, that Sam will be different. But also maybe there's a...
I would just wake up all the Sams.
Sam
like,
Army.
If you're just going to be up there, why not have a at least like enough for, I don't know, a poker game. And then you have something to do. You got a bunch of extra Sams. Maybe the company doesn't have to know about all the other Sams. And if they do, you can take them.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, sure. There's so much here to chew on that I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
And I do think...
But it doesn't get chewed on.
No.
Because like Sam 2 never says, I guess I'll go back to Earth, but I will only be alive for 3 years before my body self-destructs. Like he doesn't get to have that moment.
No. And that's what I'm saying. We're missing out on some of the deeper... like psychological discussions. Even the rescue mission that Sam is expecting is called ELIZA. And ELIZA is this 1960s computer program created by MIT, which mimicked chatting with a human operator in the manner of a therapist or a psychologist. It's actually very much the way that Gertie speaks to him in the film, which is interesting. It's like, okay, so it's like calming this person, keeping them calm. Gertie's like, by the way, it's, I said to a friend the other day, I was like, it's a bummer that Kevin Spacey is such a creepo because we don't really get these really interesting performances. I was thinking about LA Confidential and then this, it's like, he did some really great work. You know, I think.
Yeah. I was wrestling with that here. Like I was almost feeling like, am I creeped out by Gertie because I'm just creeped out by Kevin Spacey's voice now too. And I couldn't unpack that in my
heart. I actually felt easier just hearing the voice. It actually made me like not like bring anything else to it. And he's a great voice for Gertie. And I love Gertie.
Is he? Because I was having an issue with it. And I was wondering like if that's just because I'm flinchy about Kevin Spacey now.
Okay.
And so I was going too hard on the performance than I would if it was somebody else. But when I was listening to his line readings, I mean, well, you know, like, here's him talking here.
Sam, can I ask how it happened?
I told you I saw something on TV and I spilled boiling water on my hand.
You saw something on TV?
Yeah, I saw something on TV that distracted me. Is there something wrong with that, Gertie?
Sam, you said it was the TV that distracted you, but when I came in, the TV wasn't on. Perhaps you were imagining things.
I was just thinking, okay, so he doesn't sound that computery to me. Like, he doesn't sound the way Hal does. But he also doesn't sound like he's trying to be human the way that, you know, Scarlett Johansson does in her, a voice performance that I really like. He's kind of at once too neutral and too sus and too smarmy. But the smarmy might just be something I am adding that's not there because I can't take it away yet when I hear Kevin Spacey's voice.
It feels like unmodulated AI, right? I'm calm. Uh-huh. I'm speaking to you in a calm voice. But what
hungry?
I think...
Are you hungry? Are you hungry? That's the only thing I can think of to offer humans.
Yeah. Like, I think that there is something in the way that he performs that role, which I think, look, it really is just a voice. You know, he recorded all of his lines in half a day. He didn't even agree to be in the film until he saw it and actually liked it.
Oh, wow. By the way, you know how Gertie communicates not just with his kind of creepy dialect, but also through emojis. And when he has a crying face emoji, how it's just the funniest thing on the planet. I went back and I realized that emojis were not yet even on cell phones yet. He's kind of pre-emoji. Like 2009, the year that that Moon came out, was the year that a group called the Unicode Consortium got together and created the international standardization of the emojis. They agreed on 722 emojis as the standard emojis, but they weren't released yet even. They didn't release the emojis until October 2010, but we didn't even get them in America until the iPhone got them in 2011. So emojis, early emojis, we would have just been using emoticons, I guess. The colon, the parentheses.
Wow. All right. I like that. Yeah, so, you know, Sam Rockwell's not even reacting to, like, a voice track there.
Yeah, I think he's just reacting to, like, some script supervisor, maybe, just there, like, reading him lines. It sounds like this was kind of a hard shoot for Sam Rockwell.
Well, by the way, it also happens during the last writer strike. So no other productions were even going on at Shepperton Studios at that point, right? So that was actually, I think, part of the reason why they got all these great effects in the movie, right? Because the budget is $5 million. Shot in 33 days. You know, they did all this really cool stuff, but
it does look cool. I mean, I think like even one of the model makers like had worked on Alien itself. You know, good work in there.
There's so much here that I want to get into, but I don't think it gives you that much. It's
well, yeah. And also, you know, at the same time while they're shooting this movie, Duncan Jones has talked about how at the time he was like in a long distance relationship with a woman who lived in Korea. That's why the ship is named Sarang. That means love in Korean. And also, Sam Rockwell was also in a long-distance relationship, I assume with Leslie Bibb, because they were already still together. So it was like two guys on the spaceship set in a lonely, like, shooting area, really only being the two of them there. And then also the guy who's, like, doing Sam Rockwell's physical stand-in, thinking about the girls they miss. And I think that's why this movie is, I think, leaning heavily on this long-distance love affair with Tess. And I think that's why the movie thinks it affects us a little bit more than it, I feel like it actually
does. Yeah. I think that there's so much, again, to unpack. And it's like, can you look at the loneliness? Can you look at corporate? You know, like, why wouldn't even corporate give him two clones? Like, why couldn't there be a Sam and a Max? Or, you know, a Sam and Diane? Whatever. You know, like, to even give that person company, why not even do that? So you have something like that would be interesting to have, like a clone couple, like an Adam and Eve that come about. Like,
oh yeah, or two clone buddies, and they keep killing each other when one of the clones gets annoying. Like one of the clones decides that it is really into disco music, the way Jessica Chastain was in The Martian, and so they're just like, "Fuck this clone," and they kill that one and open up another one, and then try to get that clone to like Coldplay because they have terrible taste in music themselves, and so then they're just like,
Amy. Yes, exactly what I was going to say. By the way, I do want to bring up one thing too, which I think. I don't think it's canon, your podcast. But I think it is, I think it is interesting to note that the symptoms that Sam is showing, Sam one is showing, I guess people have said, are signs of acute radiation poisoning. So there is a theory that the reason why there needed to be clones in the first place isn't that his body is deteriorating in 3 years because it's like some sort of thing put in his DNA, but it's because working on the moon, he has been exposed to large doses of radiation, and that's making him ill. So in a way, what the company is doing is saying, we don't want to expose, I mean, this is a question, a regular human to that? Like, they're trying to protect, like, they know that it's unsafe to work there.
Oh, I can get that, because I have read that that is one of the risks they are worried about putting humans in space for a long time, is high rates of cancer, because you're getting, like, full-on radiation from the sun. I don't know if it hits the dark side of the moon, but I suppose it does. Anything can bounce around and reflect. And then, I mean, that brings us kind of into then a moral question that I believe is not that intensely in the movie, but I find it interesting. Yet another question, which is maybe the company's not that bad. You know, like what we know about this company is that they have created a pretty clean energy source that is keeping the world in power. We get that little advertisement at the beginning, which I like the advertisement. You could tell Duncan Jones knows his advertising.
Today, we deliver enough clean-burning helium-3 to supply the energy needs of nearly 70% of the planet. Who'd have thought? All the energy we ever needed, right above our heads.
So honestly, like, is it worth having one clone die every 3 years in order to have clean energy on this Earth and maybe combat climate change? I am inclined to say yes. I think I would kill that clone.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess this is the question that the movie does bring up, and now we are chewing on it, which is a clone a person? If the person is making a clone of themselves to do a job to save other human lives.
Right. That person has given consent to this, if original Sam gave consent.
Well, that's what I think is really interesting, is that it is, like, let's just use, for all intents and purposes, an Elon Musk saying, I'll be the person. I'll use my memories. I'm not, you know, this is my contribution. I figured out a way to make this work, to save the planet. You know, that's interesting. It's an interesting dilemma. Again, the movie doesn't give us all these, like, it's a lot of after, you know, extracurricular activity to get to this point. But I do think we are forced to answer the question of, like, when does a human become a human? But we never really have anyone posit that or even have a chance to argue that. And yet, at the same time, Gertie, who's a robot, is showing signs of being a human by saying, I need to protect you, and the way I'm protecting you is by helping you find your own humanity, which is in then Gertie's finding its own humanity. So then it makes... Then it also makes the argument that robots are human too.
Yeah, which is, I mean, I thought that was one of the stealth arguments mm-hmm. in 2001 A Space Odyssey, because that is a movie populated with kind of grim-faced people walking around. And the only person who acts like they have human emotions is Hal. Hal is the one who gets his feelings hurt, and Hal is the one who gets lonely, and Hal is like, please play chess with me, and I don't want to die. And the humans are like, here I go, into the unknown, grunt, 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 grunt. I mean, that blending of where humans lose their humanity while enriching the things we create to be more human. I mean, Gertie is the person who can be logicked with, and Sam can say, please, I don't want to die. And Gertie's like, okay. And the humans he's working with or for, Benedict Wong, are like, well, we got to kill that guy. You know, he can't rationalize with Benedict Wong back on Earth.
So I guess we're both saying at one point, the future of humanity is less important than one person, one life. Like, there's that element of, like, you know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one. But this movie is kind of saying the needs of the one outweigh the needs of the many.
I think that I'd have to disagree with
the
movie.
Right?
I mean, and I we make moral bargains every day on this earth that I do think we should look at and wrestle with more. Every time I buy, you know, a suspiciously cheap t-shirt, I have to wrestle with the fact that I'm making a bad moral bargain somewhere. and clean energy for the planet, I feel like I'd get my conscience dirty for that. Sorry, clone. I like the way the clone looks in tracksuits. I think the clone's pretty funny. Sorry, clone. I'm still going to do it.
Another issue I have simply about the logistics is, you know, one of the things they do so well production design wise, obviously, I love the way the movie looks. And I think Duncan Jones even talked to people at NASA and kind of created this idea that this moon station was built out of like mooncrete, like some sort of concrete from the moon. But, you know, when Sam 2 awakens, you know, he goes to go get his suit and he goes right to the spot where Sam 1 gets his suit. But Sam 2 has never been there. But Sam 1 has been. So is that like programmed into his head? Like he knows where his own suit is? Like, but that's for the audience to give you a clue. Like, oh, Sam 2 is confused. Why isn't his suit in his spot? But we don't know because he's never been in that spot.
Right. Or like, how is Sam 1 getting flashes of his teenage daughter on the ship when he doesn't even know she's a teenager yet and he's never seen her? Is there like a mind meld with OG Sam on Earth?
I mean, and that seems wild. I didn't even realize that was his OG daughter. I just thought that was like a beautiful woman in a chair because it kind of goes so quick. You know, Sam 1 is existing out. Like, they wake up Sam 2 pretty quickly. Seems like Sam 1 is okay, but I guess no one can get him. So they were just going to go kill him?
Yeah, they're just going to let him freeze to death.
And then, but at a certain point, the harvesters aren't working. So Sam 2 wakes up and says, okay, a harvester is down. I can't leave the premises. Like, there are some wonky logic issues. I'm sure a Redditor will disagree with me, but...
Yeah, but like, so what is the... Are the mercs showing up to get rid of the body and then just be like, hey, we were in the neighborhood. How are you?
I think the idea is your ship crashed. There's an issue. You can't leave outside. The mercs would have come, would have killed... Sam 1 replaced the truck back into its slot, and then they would say, hey, it's all good. You can go out, and your mission begins now.
Well, you know what? That's not actually even that different from what happens. Sam 1 dies,
yeah,
and then there's a Sam up there. They just skipped over one Sam. One Sam, Sam 2, gets to go home.
Yes.
Because they leave Sam 3 up there. They're like talking about killing Sam 3. And then they're like, we'll let that Sam 3 live.
But then what I think is really interesting, too.
They don't liberate all the Sams.
Well, we don't know. Maybe the sequel in Mute. But I mean, the other question that I think I found really interesting, and again, looking at it now, I didn't think about this in the moment, nor does this movie even push you to ask this question. But why don't they go past a certain point? You know, this idea like we live in our box and we don't go outside of our box. And I think that is something that is innately human. Maybe a robot would try to fix communications, but Sam, all the Sams are, or at least up until now, are content with, oh, there's an issue with the antenna. They never drive past that point. They're on the moon. They have nothing else to do. They never explore.
That's true.
And I thought that was a really interesting idea about humanity. Like a robot might want to fix it. Yeah. And I feel like what this movie does so well is give you an acting showcase. And very rarely do you see a one-person movie where you aren't impressed on some level. Like, we're watching Sam Rockwell bring it. I think we ask none of these questions because he is bringing it great. He's not overdoing it. He really is alive. I think that the budget of this movie makes it surprising. I also think that unfortunately, as we watch movies like this and we have more and more opportunities to make elevated, high concept sci-fi for low budgets, it is less impressive than it was when it originally came out.
Right, because I was trying to put myself in the headset of why this was so important feeling in 2009.
A while ago.
2009. And I think a lot of it was that was a moment where it really felt like everything was becoming CG sort of all at once.
Right.
You know, like that's Avatar year, right? 2009. That was that Oscars. And I think that practical effects hadn't been dead that long. They weren't dead so long that we didn't think like, let's make a stand for practical effects or something like that. And the way that Moon felt so tactile and small and creative felt kind of like it was a little a little David going up against like an Avatar Goliath, right? Like I remember that feeling of it being almost like an old school throwback, an old school sci-fi throwback made me really want to stick up for this movie so much. I mean that, and then also just the Sam Rockwell of it all. You know, that there's this actor that I've been loving who's been kicking around in tiny bits for years who has more than paid his dues.
I do also just want to call out, and again, in a very quick way, if you look at 2007 and 2008, oof, what a shit time for movies. There are some good ones, right? There are some good ones in there that pop up, right? There Will Be Blood, 310 to Yuma.
In Bruges. My buddy, Synecdoche, my other buddy.
You know, but then there are some, I mean, Balls of Fury. You know, we're looking at Mimsy, Mystemagoriums, Magic Emporium, you know, you know, Die Hard, Live Free or Die Hard, Spider-Man 3, you know, these movies, Number 23, Fracture, right? Like we're like,
It was like the dregs of everybody being so clever.
Yeah. And you know, and like, and again, there's always going to be great ones in there, but even 2008, like there's like 2007, 2008, it's just kind of this, okay. I mean, like I'm looking at these movies and I'm like, wow, this is like Indiana Jones and the Temple of the Crystal Skull. You know, it's like these movies that, you know, The Day the Earth Stood Still, which I know some people like.
Oh, God, the Keanu one.
Yeah. Like, you know.
Whenever I think of this period, I think of like those comedies that I approached with a lot of dread, like where people were playing dodgeball or something.
Yeah.
With, you know, with like, I'm a cool guy headbands on. I think of it's like the I'm a cool guy with a headband on and it's a dork thing.
Yes, I get that.
Aggro dork. Yeah.
No, I mean, look,
I hated that time period. And then semi-pro, a lot of just like
the rocker,
sexy girls
disaster
and
movie,
bikini movies.
Wieners. You know, it's like there's a lot. There's a lot. I mean, look, and again, always going to be great movies.
Starving for stuff that felt original, huh?
That's what I kind of think.
Starving.
You know, and I feel like we're getting it. You know, we're getting it at certain points. We're getting like The Dark Knight that year. We're getting Tropic Thunder. But we're getting a lot more shit that is not, like when you scroll through like Brendan Fraser's Journey to the Center of the Earth, it's like, okay, Australia. You know, but then there's, you know, like again.
I mean, so maybe what you're saying is today it's easy to take Moon for granted because it was part of a rising wave of cool sci-fi indies that now we just have all the time.
Yeah.
Now there's like so many cool, tiny, small, little budget indies. But this felt new then.
Right. You get to see a movie.
So much god-awful mess.
I mean, like even, you know, you're getting to see people make interesting things, you know, and I feel like there are a lot of smaller budget films, you know, anyway, I think it's.
I mean, it makes me think of like what Cord Jefferson said at the Oscars. You know, why are we making $200 million films?
I've been saying this for years.
Me too. I've been yelling about this.
I mean, the only person who seems to do that is Blumhouse. And there's no.
Yeah, I did a cover story on Blumhouse for the LA Weekly solely to make this one point and ask if we could be doing it for other genres besides horror.
But people will never do it for comedy and it sucks. And, you know, we got to figure it out. But that is, look, he is 100% right.
He is.
And I remember having a meeting with somebody at one point and they're like, well, we can't make a $15 million movie because we need to spend $30 million to advertise
it.
And it's like, well, this is a fucking weird system. Like, come on now.
Yeah. You're going to spend more advertising than making it? Stuff will find its audience somehow if it's good. It will.
But like, we also have to not take it away. Like, and that's the other thing too. If it doesn't hit like Willow, if it doesn't hit within the month, you can't take it off the platform. Like, you know, part of this thing, like, and again, this is me on my fucking high horse, but I'll go with it for a second and go like,
ooh, a high horse, not a soapbox, it's a high horse.
The reason why we like Friends, the reason why we like The Office, the reason why people are going back and watching Suits,
Married with Children,
is because there are tons of them.
Yes.
Tons of them. And,
yes.
You know, that to me is what we want. We want to be invested in a deeper thing. We don't want to just have it like one shot. Of course, we're never going to catch on to it. Like it's the worst way of making something, like making it work out of the gate. And then because of that.
Yeah. If you don't get a bullseye, it's dead.
Right.
What?
And because of that, then we start to cast up. Like I read a great X that said, you know, is two screenwriters have written a bunch of stuff. And they're like, I'm going to do the nice thing right now and not mention every executive's name that told me Ryan Gosling is not a movie star. Right.
Oh, my God.
And that's the thing, right? Like there's always like, and everyone tries to game the system. There's that whole story last week that Netflix internally said, we're not going to make any more slasher films. And then what was number one that weekend on Netflix? Thanksgiving. So it's like, no one really knows. Shit gets found because people like to find stuff. That new study that just came out that said that, you know, millennials want original ideas. Well, God bless you. Like, it's great. But it's like this, you know, what do they bring? What, you know, this idea of like, I heard a story this week. Someone was telling me they're trying to cast a very big, awesome actress in something. And they're like, well, she means nothing. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? What are you talking about? This person is like, I want to say the person's name only because you'd be like, what the fuck? It's crazy. But that's this weird thing that we get into. It's like, well, does Mr. Beast bring more? I mean, maybe. I mean, Amazon spent all their documentary budget on Mr. Beast. By the way, I have no slight on Mr. Beast because the docs that he's doing is like real life Squid Game and it's crazy and I'm all for it.
No, but it's crazy. It's crazy. This play it safe thing. Oh, all I want is more chances to elevate the Sam Rockwells when they finally get that part. You know what I mean? I mean, I feel like even if somebody was trying to do Moon today, they'd almost need somebody Sam Rockwell's size, as Sam Rockwell's size is right now, mm-hmm. to get that movie made.
Yep.
You know, because everything is so dependent on like the tiny amount of cast, 25 names, 50 names. It's too small a list of names.
And by the way, I think it's 10 names. I don't think it's 25 names. I don't think it's 50 names. Because if it's 50 names, then Ryan Gosling's on that list of 50. You couldn't, you know, but now because of Barbie and this and Fall Guy, it's different. It's a very tricky time. And you just have to kind of make your own shit. And that's it.
It's so fear oriented. Yeah. I mean, the make your own shit is the part of it. Like, I mean, it helps when you're Duncan Jones making your own shit when you can, you know, scrape up $5 million a little easier than the average person can.
Right.
I mean, one of the people who helped fund Moon, and I loved this because it's a lovely throwback, not just to our beloved episode on our favorite llama lover, you know, Trudy Styler, talking about The Emperor's New Groove. Trudy Styler did help fund Moon. She helped produce it because she has a soft spot for sci-fi movies because Sting did Dune, the David Lynch Dune. That was her exact quote. She said, Sting did Dune all those years ago. And I think that was a very underrated and brilliant film. And so she helped fund Moon. Thank you for that, Mrs. Styler.
I love it. Trudy Styler, again, that documentary she made, I wish people could see it, about The Emperor's New Groove. She's great.
Go to archive.org, the greatest site on the universe.
I love it. All right. Well, Amy, I think that we did it. We talked about Moon. I think that here's what I'm going to say. Last week, we talked at length about this idea. Moon is better than Martian. And I am leaving these two episodes going, Martian's better than Moon.
I definitely am too. And I wasn't sure I would have said that before this rewatch.
Yep, me neither.
I will say, production design wise, there is a lot I admire about Moon. And in fact, Moon sent me on a real rabbit hole detour based on that scene early on where Sam Rockwell is getting his hair cut with the Floby. I was like, oh yeah, Floby. You know, Floby,
yeah.
The vacuum haircut thing. I started trying to look up what happened to Floby, and I found an original Floby commercial from the 80s where the Floby guy was predicting that Flobys would have use in space.
We have big plans for it, and a really fun, exciting thing to me is watching it when it's going to go into outer space. I mean, we're going to have a space station, and now they can cut hair in outer space. They couldn't do that before.
And then to tie it all together with our conversation that we had last week about how it feels like we keep sending the same actors to space, one of those actors we mentioned who is always making movies set in space is a Floby guy, has been obsessed with Flobys since the 90s. You'll recognize his voice. Here he is.
So years ago, I bought a thing called a Floby, which when we
you
were
did
kid,
not.
When I was a kid, yeah.
The infomercial, the Floby.
This ingenious device lets you give yourself and family perfect haircuts every time.
Yes. It comes with a vacuum cleaner and the clippers? Yeah, I still have it.
Stop it. You don't use it.
My haircuts take literally 2 minutes. I go,
Is this Floby?
Yeah, it's Floby.
That is awesome.
Yeah, listen, man, it works.
Yes, George Clooney came out during the pandemic, said he'd been using a Floby for years, said he doesn't have a lot of hair. Why wouldn't he use a Floby? And when he said that, Floby sales skyrocketed and it got impossible to buy Flobys during the pandemic. Thank you for your service, George Clooney.
Thank you, George. And by the way, you know, just to tie one more loose end together, Ryan Gosling, Fall Guy premiered just last week at South by Southwest. And we talked about him being the next or one of the next people going off to make a lone person in space movie. So everything just comes back full circle here. Can Ryan Gosling do this? We said that we think he can. So we'll see now next week what all will be.
The man's already been to space.
And he'll be back again. I love it. You know, so Amy, I think it's only right that as we kick it back to one of our old episodes, we should maybe look at High Noon, a movie that I didn't like. Maybe I should go back and watch it. I'm going away for a little bit. Maybe I'll put that on the iPad for another rewatch to see where I fall on it. But maybe if you want to hear our conversation about it and see the similarities yourself, go for it.
Well, Paul, I know I mourned last week that you were going to go away for a while, but it turns out I've been able to hold you close to me and yes. my mic a little bit longer. So I get one more week with you after this one. Huzzah!
Huzzah!
So Paul, that just means it feels like a holiday to me. And we have a holiday coming up. We have Easter. And I have been wanting to do this movie with you for a very long time. I just saw this movie big in the theater with many members of the original cast. This movie is such a banger. Such a crowd pleaser. Such a everybody get around and sing around on the microphone with us. We have to do Jesus Christ Superstar.
Oh my gosh. Never saw it.
Oh, it is a bop and a half. Oh, goodness. Oh, you're going to just jam out.
I can't wait. All right. I'm ready for it. I can't wait. Our show could not be done without our team. And a huge thank you goes to them each and every week. Produced and edited by Cody Fisher and our associate producer, Jessica Cisneros. Our engineer is Casey Holford and our MVP is Molly Reynolds. Our theme song is by Michael Cassidy and our fan art is by Kim Troxell. Check it out all on social media. And you can find us on social media at Unspooled on Twitter and Instagram. And you can join in the conversation about all things Unspooled on the Paul Scheer Discord at discord.gg/Paul Scheer. There's an entire Unspooled section. T-shirts, mugs, stickers, and all Unspooled merch are available at tpublic.com/unspooled. And you can get a deck of Unspooled playing cards and more merch at podswag.com. That's right. And if you can't get enough Unspooled, you can listen to our archive for free anywhere you get your podcast. But remember to rate and review us. It does help. And finally, you can always check out the API list. That's right, the ever-growing list that we will eventually shoot into space at unspooled.com. And just a reminder, my book, Joyful Recollections of Trauma, comes out May 21st. You can pre-order it now, and if you do, I'll be so thankful. See you next time. Bye for now.
Hi there, this is Mary Holland. You may know me from Happiest Season, or Veep, or The Woman in the House Across the Street from the Girl in the Window, or you may know me as Janice Cramps. Huh? I want to wish Comedy Bang Bang a happy 15th anniversary. Wow, 15 years old. Comedy Bang Bang is about to get its driver's permit. I'm so excited for it. And I'm, you know, really grateful because Comedy Bang Bang has brought me so much joy as a listener and a performer. And I'm just very grateful for this community that we have in Comedy Bang Bang. You can hear me and a lot of other very funny people on Comedy Bang Bang wherever you get your podcasts. So what are you waiting for? Tune in.